September the 14th of the commission to order, please. Our first item is approval of the consent agenda.
Well, unless there's any further questions, I move that we approve the consent agenda, which includes the minutes of the August 24th meeting, the claim vouchers for August 24th through September 8th, for a total of $3,257,000, $723.20. Payroll vouchers for period August 1st through August 31st, and the removal of delinquent accounts from September 2020 active accounts receivable in amount of $7,116.71, including a 30% collection fee.
I'm sorry, I do have one question on the claim voucher, Sean. You've got, I forget which voucher it is, but there's a charge there for $4,000 to Sound Publishing for advertisement. What exactly is that?
Nicole, can you answer that maybe?
What was the item?
It's $4,000 charge to Sound Publishing.
Oh, that's the hot one.
The hot one, okay. Yeah. That's the newsletter that goes out to all the residents
of
the
county.
Okay, so it's the printing cost?
Yeah, they do the printing, and then there's another amount for the postage.
Okay. That's all I had. So I'll second the motion to approve the consent agenda with the items shown.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded for approval of the consent agenda of September the 14th for the items described previously. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, agenda revisions. Doug, do we have any?
Yeah, I'd like to add a third one to the staff report. It's called BPA Secondary Sales, and Sean will take the lead on that.
I was going to recommend the same thing, so that's great, Doug.
Okay, thanks.
Any other items from the commission?
Nope.
Okay, good. Assuming none. Comments from the public. Sean, do we have someone?
If anybody would like to make a comment at this time, please give me your first name, and I will go in the order received.
Christine, Sean.
Don Jordy, huh?
Don Quixote, yeah. I just have it's just a question, actually, rather than a comment about earlier this morning. You were talking about, not having any weatherization and incentives, for landowners. Is it possible for us to, for the PUD to provide some type of incentive for the landowners, the rental properties? That seems to be a big, black hole in conservation.
Yeah, Christine, this is John. I'll answer that.
Okay.
The way you see this structured, we're not precluded from doing weatherization for landowners or property owners to mitigate a tenant's energy assistance need. We have to be careful doing that because what will happen or can happen is somebody who typically has energy assistance need can move fairly frequently, so we would go through basically numerous houses, weatherization to address the issue. But, there's no prohibition for landlord properties being weatherized under CEDAR. We're not precluded from doing that.
Well, that I understood, but I'm wondering if we couldn't give some kind of incentive to make them do it.
Yes.
We don't want to spend the money.
Yeah, absolutely. We could do an incentive, and we could out-and-out pay for the entirety. And an incentive, if that works, would be preferred.
Okay, thank you.
I guess the problem I can see with that is the low-income person, the renter, may not get the benefit of it. So
I actually wasn't looking so much towards a low-income person getting a benefit other than the property just being covered and the whole community getting a benefit from it. The whole environment becoming being a beneficiary.
Yeah, I'm unsure whether that meets the intent of CETA, but we'll look into that. Okay, other questions?
You could get the landlord increase in rent then, too.
Yeah.
Well, if they're paying the utility bill, I see that's not the issue.
That's true, but I think a lot of renters do pay the utility bill.
Exactly. That's my point. Yeah,
that's what we've run into in the past. The renter pays the utility bill. The landlord's not really interested in reducing the bill by any conservation measures. But
hence comes my question about whether we could incentivize them to do so.
Okay, understood. Okay. Understood.
Thank you.
Other questions? Comments?
I don't have anything else, Bill.
Okay, business items. We only have one. Resolution 2180-20, declaring an emergency and authorizing certain emergency work. Tom Martin, are you on?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon, Commissioners.
Hi.
This has to do with our Clallam Bay Reservoir. There was logging done on the property behind the reservoir up to our property line. And that left the trees on our property, which were a line of trees around the reservoir that were subject to higher risk of being blown down because there was no other trees around them anymore to protect them from wind. So in these cases, we like to cut down those trees as soon as we can. So the logging company that was out there logging was already on site, already mobilized. It was the fastest, least cost option to take down those trees on our property. So that was the emergency that we're seeking your approval for.
So was this merchantable timber that was on our property?
You know, I've seen pictures of the trees. I got a picture on September 8th where the trees had been taken down. And as far as being merchantable, you know, they could be, but right now they're just laying on the ground. They're about 2 to 3 feet in diameter.
This has got to be a recurring theme where loggers will log right up to the last line of trees before our power lines, and in the first windstorm, down they come. So it's a real problem.
I guess I have a process question here. Does this really require resolution? I mean, given the amount of money, the urgency, and the fact, I guess you've already done it. So I'm just curious, does something like this really require resolution?
I believe to satisfy the RCWs it does, but
okay. I think it was mainly because we did it already, just to back up the fact that it's been done already.
Yeah. Yeah, basically we departed from the procurement manual and potentially RCWs, and technically this should have gone through a different process than an emergency initiation of a contract. But you save money by doing that. That is correct.
And it is correct that in the past we had a similar situation and we did deal with it with a resolution because it was an emergency.
Do we not have a cost threshold or something, you know, a minimum amount where you don't have to do a resolution? I mean, what if it was only $1,000?
Yes, we do. We do have cost levels, and I think the main reason on this one, again, is because it was an emergency. But I don't know if there's a level on the emergency side of it or not. But we can look at that, Jim.
Yeah, as I understand it, you're supposed to have informal phone quotes for anything over, I can't remember the dollar amount, but it's low, below $5,000 or below.
Okay.
Okay, so do we have a resolution? A motion?
If I could...
Yeah, I move that we pass Resolution 2180-20 declaring an emergency and authorizing emergency work for the trees that were a potential threat to the Clallam Bay Reservoir for the quoted price of $1,600.
I'll second the motion.
It's been moved and seconded to approval of Resolution 2180-20, declaring an emergency in accordance with RCW's 39.04.280 and authorizing certain emergency work without formal bid for removing trees next to the Clallam Bay Reservoir to be awarded to Dahlgreen Logging, Inc. for a quoted amount of $1,600. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right, next item is correspondence communications. Doug, do we have any?
Well, I guess I'll bring this up just because I looked at it between our meetings here, and it kind of fit with our earlier meetings, and interesting, and it's out of news data clearing up. Benton County PUD says Northwest needs nuclear, not wind. Goes on to say developers want to build one of the world's, Washington's biggest wind farms about 10 miles south of Benton County PUD headquarters. However, the utility hopes the Horsehaven proposal stays on the drawing board because it officially opposes further wind development in the Pacific Northwest to serve Washington's load, a position that its commissioners adopted July 14th after releasing the report on wind power and clean energy policy perspectives. It says the utility has instead endorsed transitioning from coal to natural gas to nuclear, particularly small modular reactors under development of, which we talked about earlier, an Oregon-based NuScale Power to meet zero carbon emissions mandates set in the state's Clean Energy Transformation Act, which CETA, which we talked about earlier too. We believe it is reasonable to suggest the most balanced and environmentally responsible actions you can take to clean up the electricity sector is to produce as much low or non-emitting electricity as possible in the smallest area possible, Benton PUD official position said. This seems to be best accomplished with energy dense fuels like natural gas and uranium. I haven't finished the article, but it goes on to point out six reasons why they think that's the reason that they went ahead and passed that. So anyway, considering what we talked about this morning, I thought that was interesting and to look at it further. That's all, Will.
Okay, good. Thank you. Next item is commissioner reports. Dave, you want to go first?
Sure. Did attend the WAPEG monthly meeting. I see that Sean's going to be talking about secondary sales, which is a big part of that discussion, so I think I'll pass on that for now. As far as the NOAANet monthly meeting, I see Steve's going to talk about that, so I'll move on to other things here. And maybe just a note regarding the discussion this morning about the cost of solar farms. I think a question came up as to whether it would cost more to construct a solar farm in the Mojave Desert of California compared to Eastern Washington or SWIM. And although it's been 30 years since I worked in California, California doesn't tax labor on outsourced work, whereas Washington does. So I'd say you got a margin there that would probably make things pretty equal with, or possibly give the California project a little better numbers than we would Washington project, just for the record there. Let's see. The North Olympic Development Council meeting, there's been two different meetings since our last meeting, one with the consultant that's putting together the needs assessment in the county, and then their monthly meeting, and both of those focus a lot on pretty much on broadband, more than anything else utility related. So got a rundown on what the tribes are doing out at the Macaw tribe. They're doing a lot of testing at different parts of the reservation, and just to see how what the services quality is in different places there. And they've got transmitters on Ellis Mountain, which is about due south of CQ, about halfway down to Beaver, Tahoka's Peak. So they're doing a lot of testing between where the towers are and the different locations that they need the broadband. So that's kind of an ongoing thing. Question came up about funding, and as most of you know, we are applying for a grant to put a fiber backbone going out from the Elwha River out to Fort LaPush. And the question comes up, well, you know, is there other sources of funding we can look at? And for those that may not be aware, there are three PUDs out of the 28 that I'm aware of that actually assess property taxes in their service areas, Jefferson, Kitsap, and Thurston. So I think Jefferson mentioned that they are going to use a lot of their the money they get from property taxes to fund their broadband infrastructure improvements. I know talking to Kitsap about a year ago, I think they get about $1.5 million from property taxes. They use about $1 million of that on broadband. And so it suggested that, you know, we look into the property tax angle, which I don't believe Clallam PUD has ever done, but I'd say just based on the discussion we have in many of our meetings that, you know, the upward pressure on electrical rates, especially for small businesses, that those same small businesses are paying property tax either indirectly or directly. So I would not be in favor of any property tax assessments for broadband, and definitely not impacting the electric ratepayers to fund it. So I think the other funding sources that we're looking at is, yeah, I basically told them that what we're looking at in the way of getting grants or loans is going to be the primary funding sources for moving forward on some of these projects. What else here? Interesting article I read in the August 28th edition of ProPublica. I know the reason I'm bringing this up is because it had to do with prescribed burns in California. And this is something that when I was going to college, I was working seasonally in the summer for the Forest Service. And the extreme north end of California did a lot of controlled burns, prescribed burns. And even back then, they were saying that what was being done in the way of prescribed burns was woefully inadequate. I think the estimate this article gave is that back before anybody started doing any forestry in California, you know, hundreds of years ago, that somewhere between 4.4 and 11 million acres burned naturally every year. And back, you know, during the last quarter of the 20th century, I think they were only doing prescribed burns on 30,000 acres. And now in the last 20 years, that's dropped from 30,000 to 13,000 acres. So it seems like they're going the wrong direction on that. And again, the reason I bring this up is because utilities, I think, are getting having to bear more than their fair share of the brunt of wildfires and things like that. There's no question that there's culpability there, but there's a lot of other things that can be done to help the fire situation, which, you know, now I think everybody all up and down the West Coast is feeling the effects of the extreme fires, which obviously climate change and other things are the cause of. But, you know, the failure to expand the prescribed burning over the years has actually made these fires bigger, in my opinion. So I'd say that's something that because so many of the fires occur in national forests, and the smoke tends to go out of state, and as we're seeing now, that the federal government should probably be taking the lead on trying to put some teeth into regulations that require that states burn a certain number of acres every year just as a preventative measure. And obviously, the problem is real much bigger in California than anywhere else, but you know, Oregon and Washington have that same problem on a smaller scale. So just something to think about in discussing issues with the federal elected representatives, since that's, I think, where the most effective move forward on this is likely to happen. So that's about all I have today.
Okay. Thank you, Dave. You know, that issue of property taxes, that's come up quite frequently during my tenure here, and we've always reached the same conclusion you have. It's not a good idea.
And also, well, the three utilities that Dave mentioned, they're all just water utilities, and they've had more of a history on those property taxes than any of the electric have.
Right, except Jefferson, of course.
Right, but they were originally just a water.
Yeah, well, that's right, yeah. Hey, Jim?
Yeah, okay, I participated in the WAPAG meeting, too, and so we, you know, the bigger part of the meeting was discussing the secondary sales and how BPA has got this new idea of how to apply the surcharge or not, and we'll talk more about that when Sean starts the briefing there. The other thing they talked about at the WAPAG briefing was the I had a little presentation on the impacts, what was going on in Southern California with the, you know, the blackouts or so forth that happened for a few hours or a few minutes. So we talked a little bit about that. It was interesting also to note another Clearinghouse article about that, where it was this author of this particular article pointed out that at the same time that this heat wave prediction was going on, 5,000 megawatts roughly of resources was removed for various reasons, lots of different things, but a couple of big power plants were taken off for scheduled maintenance and so forth. And so his conclusion was, is what really happened there was not a demand increase, but simply a resource depletion of roughly 5,000 megawatts. And so the governor asked for investigations and so forth. So we'll see how all that plays out. The other meeting I participated in on the, it was over a course of 3 days, the 25th through the 27th of August, was the BPA 22 rate case presentations. And this is, of course, an ongoing thing. A couple of interesting notes, though. They had a couple charts in there about the load forecast and the resource forecast for the, you know, the 22-23 rate case period. And these charts noted that basically the load forecasts are down 239 megawatts, and the resource forecasts are down by a very similar amount. So basically, what BPA in their authority area is predicting for, you know, demand and so forth is basically flat during that rate period. The other thing, they had a chart that showed in the WEC the changes in the resource mix with coal going out and so forth. And I think what was notable is they're showing battery. And this fits in with what we talked about, John, you presented this morning, is that they're showing significant battery inclusions in the resource mix. They're starting to make a very positive, you know, impact on the coal closures as you go out, you know, past 2023. They also showed the renewable generation and just had a note at the bottom there that this just in 22 and 23, they didn't even talk about this year and next year, but in those 2 years, over 5,000 megawatts of solar and wind will be added each year, and that this is putting substantial downward price pressure on rates. So a lot of flux going on here, and so that's all part of the discussion in the rate case. And there was an Economic Development Council meeting I dialed into for a bit of on the 2nd of September, but most of the discussion was about Black Ball Ferry and so forth. And as much as I racked my brain trying to figure out a role that could play in that. I didn't come up with anything. So anyway, that's all I have.
Hey, Will, this is John. You're muted. First time I've ever done that. Okay, I'll start over. All right, the Energy Northwest Executive Board has an annual workshop. This year they held it at Suncadia, which is, there was a lot of trepidation about doing that, but it was really amazing how they had us in this huge room and we were spaced out wearing masks, no food. Basically, it was miserable, but we did it. So, anyway, we got some things done. One of the interesting things was the CEO of Energy Northwest, Brad Schlusky, who's done a really good job for us, has agreed to stay through the next refueling outage, which is considered a win, because this next refueling outage is going to be a complicated one. We're doing some fairly major projects during that outage, and Brad is one of these hands-on guys, and he'll be on the spot and taking charge of that activity. So that was a good thing. All the metrics for Columbia look very good, with the exception of two. One was the major one was the equipment reliability, and there's two villains there. One is the recirc pumps, which have had some problems, and the main one is the adjustable speed drive, which drives those pumps. Those are old systems. They have printed circuit boards, which have been reverse engineered, continuous failures. In fact, now they're kind of running on a wing and a prayer. The plan is to replace those in refueling outage R28, and that's about a $50 million expenditure, but it keeps the plan online for relicensing and reliability. It seems to be necessary. We had a very good, we had a presentation by Kevin Norrett from Grant, and he went on about new technologies, the coal retirements and resource adequacy. Grant is interested in taking a position in an SMR on Site 1, which is right next to Columbia, and those discussions are ongoing. He talked about the changing consumer preferences for green power, environmental concerns, and Western integration in the Cal ISO. It's kind of interesting that Elliot Menzer went down to head up Cal ISO. He's been kind of pushing for Bonneville and the Northwest to get involved in that. Kind of talked about risk, and it occurred to me we have a matrix of risk tolerance for the Executive Board of Energy Northwest. That might be something that we'd be interested in doing here as a board. You know, for different projects, different initiatives, different things, what's our appetite for risk? And, you know, they don't have to be that specific, either low or high or medium. But it might give staff a little better handle on how we feel about things. Then went on to let's see what else is going on. Yeah, during this heat wave, Columbia was under a no-touch order to avoid any types of possible shutdowns of the plant. They said that Columbia was critical to maintaining balance on the grid. The next item I participated in was the Nuclear Safety Review Board, which I've been a member for a number of years.
talked quite a bit about equipment reliability and what could be done. This is where they bring in nuclear experts to audit the plant from soup to nuts. They do interviews. They do plant walkdowns. And the equipment reliability is the biggest concern. And like I said before, that one problem, the major problem, seems to be the adjustable speed drives. Also talked about what they evaluated was the chemical and radiation protection performance was flat. And that's a concern because this next refueling outage, there's a number of high-dose projects. And Columbia's been trying to get the requirements for dose reduced for work performed during an outage because you have to perform high-dose projects. They're necessary for maintenance of the plant, but they ding you on performance. So they're trying to get that changed. Don't know how that'll go. Also went to the NOAANet, called in to the NOAANet board. They are doing a bond issue, or in fact, they're. I don't know if they approved it. Dave, did you call into that one? Did they approve that or not?
No, they did approve it.
Okay, that was kind of interesting because in order to get lower interest rates and good terms from bond issuers, they had to put in there that participants in NOAANet would back up or be liable for those loans. They did get a lower interest rate by doing that, but they're going to go to each of the 10 participants and ask for 10% backup. Kind of interesting that Ponderay was one that spoke up and said that they didn't feel like it was unacceptable risk. And somebody came on, and I didn't catch who did this, but just really gave them a hard time about that. Said you probably shouldn't be a member of NOAANet, and you don't appreciate the NOAANet mission. It seemed to be totally inappropriate because that's up to that commission and that board to decide what they could do. Now, by the bylaws, you're kind of on the hook. You can't really say no. You can say, well, we'll only back up 0% or 2% or whatever, but maybe you can do something less than 10%. But opting out is not an option because of the bylaws, you can be expelled from NOAANet. So anyway, that went through and was approved. So we'll be talking about that, I assume, in the future meeting when they come to us for what percentage we're willing to underwrite. We've had no discussion on that so far. I guess that's enough. That's enough. That's all I had. Okay, our next item is staff reports. We've got a report on NOAANet bonds by Steve. Sure, that's very appropriate, Steve.
Yeah, I'll just keep going with where you left off. That individual was Chris Folto from Benton that was really laying into Ponderay. I've known Chris for a number of years, and that's just the way he is. He's just a little bit full of himself and thinks he can just push people around. Currently, we are at 10.57% ownership of NOAANet. So when the issue came up of everybody doing a 10% portion of these bonds, I basically said, well, we're not even going to get in on the conversation because it really doesn't affect us. We're already at 10%.
Yeah.
Simply because it's implied, like you said, in the bylaws. So for those that don't know, Jim, you were the only one that wasn't on the call. In that board meeting, they did approve a motion to go forward with the issuance of the $25 million in bonds, which started a 60-day clock review period for Dave Spencer to go out and start looking for bond proceeds. Doug and Will and John and I have all looked at the paperwork and the proposals for that, and we really can't opt out, and we're probably going to have to approve it simply because we can't opt out of NOAANet. What that $25 million breaks down to is they have about $12 million in over about four or five loans that they've taken out over the years. So that money would pay off those loans, and then they would have, they would do a 900, basically a $1 million draw for a 10-year period, $1 million every year for 10 years for capital projects. So that's what the bonds are going to be about. So we can talk about it further if we need to. I'll bring back to the board as it progresses, and we'll see what the rates actually look like once they actually start shopping. So that's kind of where that is at.
There was one statement that made that the none of this applied to Energy Northwest. Now, I was kind of confused by that, and I'm going to ask the question at Energy Northwest, but you know, in the past, Energy Northwest is one-on-one loan money to Nornet. I don't know why the bylaws would not apply to Energy Northwest, although it's, you know, it's been discussed during this acquisition or merger between Energy Northwest and Nornet that Energy Northwest doesn't get a lot of benefit from it. But do you know what they were talking about there, that this may not apply?
I think what Dean, who's the IT manager for Energy Northwest, was alluding to there was, and I think it does apply to them, but he was basically bowing out, saying he didn't have any authority yet to make a decision one way or the other. So he was kind of crawfishing a little bit on that, I think, is what all that boiled down to. Out of the 10 members, 8 approved going ahead with the 60-day review period. Bonner, Energy Northwest abstained, and then Ponteray was negative on the vote. So that's kind of where it stands.
Yeah, I think Dean was right. He got to have board approval.
Yeah, he did, just like we have to have board approval for us to take on 10% of the guarantee of those bonds.
Exactly, yeah.
So, yeah, well, there's more to come.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Any questions or comment on that? Okay, our next item is CARES update by Sean.
Yeah, just real quick update here. As you guys know, we got a sub-recipient agreement with the county to receive CARES funds. We received $45,200. That was at the end of August. And to date, unfortunately, we've only been able to disperse $5,325 to 22 customers, leaving us a balance of $39,875 that we have to use by the end of October. We have been proactively advertising through our website, the radio, hand-delivered door hangers to our customers, phone calls to past due customers, and also trying to promote it through OLECAP. And, you know, the real hang-up is that customers have to prove that they have some sort of COVID hardship. And the preferred method of that would be, this is from the county, that they would prefer to show, you know, some type of reduction in income, either a positive test result or caring for somebody in their family. And that's really what's been troubling is you know, people that have applied for the grants we've had to deny because they've had a raise through COVID, so they're making more money and they can't prove that they've had a COVID hardship, or just they don't have any documentation, and we have to have the documentation in order to provide them a grant. So unfortunately, we have a lot of money left. We're advertising the heck out of it, and we just aren't getting the customers to respond that we thought that we would. So that's kind of where we're at right now. I have just under 40,000 left to disperse by the end of October. And so CSRs are continuing to call. We're going to continue to leave door hangers, but we've reached out to, you know, all of our existing past due customers, and that's where we're at right now.
What kind of evidence do they have to provide that they've lost their jobs or been laid off or furloughed or what?
Yeah, we've been reviewing anything they've provided to us, and we're just sort of looking at it on a case-by-case basis, whether it's an unemployment letter, a letter from their employer saying that they have reduced hours, anything, to be honest. And we've even had some self-attestations that we've used for a couple folks out in the West End. And, you know, basically they're just self-identifying that they had a hardship. And we've used that. So we're trying to be creative, and we're asking the customer to give us whatever they have to prove a hardship.
And this is just individuals, not businesses, huh?
Correct. It has to be a residential repair. The businesses is being held or being helped through the EDC.
Yeah, we started originally looking at the honor code with the customers, but the county insisted on some paperwork or some proof that, which I can understand, but as you see, we're having problems with that now.
We can't give away money. That's a novel problem.
Hey, Sean, this is John. We had a discussion on the impact of disconnects and the lack thereof as maybe contributing to the problem.
Yeah, that's a great point. We do have some customers that we've reached out to that say, well, I'm not going to apply for anything because you're not going to disconnect me. And we politely explained to them, well, yes, the governor has a proclamation in effect that says that we can't perform utility disconnects right now, but you, at some point, will have to pay that money back. So right now, it's just an idle threat that we will eventually disconnect them, but until the real fear of us showing up and pulling their meters is put into place, there's just not a lot of motivation.
Wow.
You know, if we were out disconnecting right now, I suspect that we would probably burn through this grant money relatively quickly.
Well, that's disappointing.
And right now, the disconnect goes to what, October 15th, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So, and this has to be paid out by the 31st of October, right?
Yes, we might have a 2-week mad dash.
So, this has been extended before, though, George.
Right.
So, people must think it's going to go further. Maybe, who knows?
Probably after election, anyway.
Yeah, that's right. Everything depends on the election. Other comments, questions on that one? All right, our next item is BPA secondary sales. Is that you, Sean?
Yeah, I guess I will start off on this one. As Jim and Dave both pointed out, we brought to our attention through WAPEG that BPA had a proposal out how they're going to handle their secondary, or proposal to handle their secondary sales differently than how they do it right now. We have since learned that unofficially BPA might be pulling the proposal because they received a letter from PPC stating that their members are against any changes to how secondary sales are handled. But to kind of give a pretty broad overview, I'm going to let Tyler go over what we learned at the WAPEG meeting for all those that weren't there. So Tyler, if you're on, go ahead and kind of give an overview real quick of the secondary sales proposal.
Hi, Tyler King, Power Analyst. So BPA has overestimated the revenue from the secondary sales in the marketplace for several years. Falling power rates have caused revenue shortfalls for BPA. And this is one of the largest sources of revenue risk. So BPA tried to propose an idea to be more conservative with the forecasting for power sales. So they developed a formula. The formula is the minimum of the actual power sales in the prior period or the next period's forecast, whichever is lower. So this is just to sort of minimize the expectation of secondary sales in the market. And their secondary sales is what Bob calls the sale of the excess electricity that the preference customers do not use. And BPA argues that this will provide stable power rates, and it will also give BPA some cushion on their reserves so they don't have to implement a cost recovery clause or raise rates drastically in the next period. So PPC has sent a letter to the board of we don't want this, and BPA, or at least the folks I talked to at BPA have stated that public power doesn't want this. We shouldn't do it. So unofficially, BPA has dropped the proposal, but there is nothing official out yet.
And so what Ryan Neal at WAPEC needs from our utility is basically either we're going to support it as a utility or we're not going to support it. Now, we haven't received anything official yet that says that BPA is going to drop a proposal, but just through unofficial channels, we've heard that they're going to drop it and it's not going to be a part of this rate case. But having said that, does the commission have a preference one way or the other if we support the proposed secondary sales proposal or not?
And you're saying that PPC said they do not support it, right?
They did send a letter to Bonneville saying that all of their member utilities are not in support.
Yeah.
And because of that, because of that many people coming forward and in public power saying they're not in support of it, it's likely that Bonneville is going to withdraw the proposal.
So it kind of demonstrates that to Bonneville, PPC speaks for public power. So,
well, my view, after listening to WAPEC and digging into the charts and the background behind all this and the history with BPA and their cost control activities and so forth, it's almost a wash. And Sean and I have talked about this, and Ryan and I. But one thing that I don't like about their proposal, I think it reduces transparency in terms of how we see them managing cost, and it also takes the heat off a little bit because they're basically cushioning their reserves up front, and I just feel like it's and I don't know what the reasoning for PPC was, but having talked to other commissioners about this, I think that it may be similar to that, or at least that's one of their concerns. But anyway, so my view is that I don't support the BPA's proposal either.
Dave,
I would say that the transparency issue is probably the thing that leads me to not support it also.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I agree with that.
Okay, I will I'll reach out to Ryan at WAPEC and let him know that Colin did not support moving forward with the proposal.
Okay, good. More on that?
If it's withdrawn altogether, probably won't hear anything else about it, but if it does move forward, I'll definitely come forward and let you guys know any additional information. And I'm sure that I'll hear about it through WAPEC with Jim and Dave also.
Is WAPEC a good conduit to monitor PPC's positions? Is that
Ryan Neal typically, I believe, is in almost all the PPC meetings. So
yeah, Ryan does go to those meetings. So he hears what's going on and hears what the other utilities are reporting.
Good, good, good.
And he talks to them a lot too. And he and I have talked about how all this stuff is swirling around and who's playing and who's talking to who.
Yeah. Right. Okay, thanks, Sean.
Yeah, you bet.
Action items, do we have any?
We do not.
No action items, that's good. Okay, next item is comments from the public. Sean, do we have anybody?
Nothing through chat, but if anybody else would like to make a comment, go ahead and let me know, and I'll put you on the list.
None?
I'm hearing none, Will.
Okay, good. All right, we will recess from the commission meeting and go into executive session to talk about possible litigation potential.
Yeah, Will.
I don't think that'll last, Doug.
Yeah, well, Will, we're waiting for Ryan from Don Cohen's office to join us. We had told him about 2:30, so if we could take a break till 2:30 and...
Doug, I just emailed him and he's going to jump on right now.
Oh, good. Okay. He said don't bother, you saying?
No, he was going to jump on, I think.
Oh, right now?
Yeah, he's going to jump on here in the next 50 seconds, he said.
Okay, all right.